Hello and welcome to the MMQB NFL Podcast. I'm Gary Grantley.
I'm Jenny Brentis.
And I'm Connor Orr.
And it was a Week 10 Sunday full of blowouts. Lots of lopsided games, but very interesting narratives coming out of those games, perhaps. And we're going to start with one of those blowout games. That was a Sunday nighter. Chiefs go into Las Vegas in what was going to be a game to decide control currently of the AFC West and completely blow out a Raiders team that, frankly, has played them pretty close the last couple of meetings here. But, yeah, Chiefs end up, I don't know, getting right to an extent, at least it seems like.
Yeah, it was the offensive explosion that we had come accustomed to from the Chiefs, but hadn't seen much of this season. Now, some of the plays that the Chiefs made were of a similar reckless variety that in previous weeks ended up being interceptions, and this week ended up being amazing touchdowns. So it sort of shows you the line between good and bad in the NFL, but certainly they looked like a team that was playing more confidently and that could get guys open and that could complete some of those deep passes that they've just been off on all season long.
You know, what's weird to me, though, is that we consider it a Chiefs game when, like, Patrick Mahomes throws for 400 yards and five touchdowns, when it's just, I think we're continuously reassuring ourselves of something that is not replicable over the long term, right? Patrick Mahomes cannot play like this over a long period of time, like over the life of this contract, for example. And so for me, it's like, I would like to see like a different thing. You know what I mean? Like, as beautiful as this brand of football is and as entertaining as this brand of football is, if I'm a Chiefs fan, I'm like, okay, this is sort of like, you know, we went back and we like squeezed into our old pants and it felt good, you know, but you should get new pants. You know, this team needs some new pants.
Well, as far as tonight goes, I mean, yeah, we've been hearing all season, these two high safety looks, as if no one had thought of that to do against the Chiefs the last couple of years. And it's just been something of a different result this year. And I think you kind of hit on it, Jenny. We had a couple of reckless throws by Mahomes. Almost all of those have been becoming interceptions or turnovers or something disastrous so far this season. But, I mean, look, in this league, a 50-50 ball is more like 80-20 for the offense, considering the potential for a flag, considering the, you know, the reality that many defensive backs don't have very good ball skills in this league anymore. So, you know, you sort of had a first half with some screen passes, some things to sort of rein Mahomes in a little bit, and then as soon as he started getting some of those single high looks, he started taking shots. They didn't necessarily work as in they were wise throws to make, but they worked in that they worked. They resulted in points. Sometimes, I mean, that's kind of why you got Patrick Mahomes, to sort of mix those plays in here.
And too, I mean, I think to your guys' point too, I mean, it wasn't like this was some sort of like, you know, it wasn't like a Texas Tech game where, you know, every throw was just a drop back and a shootout. I think basically a third of his 50 attempts were right over the middle in that 5 to 10 yard range, which is kind of that bread and butter where he's able to get Kelce and Hill and be able to get comfortable. By the way, Connor or X Factor, Noah Gray scoring in this one. So wanted to make sure that was note of note. But so with that, you know, you can almost blame the Raiders in some respect, because I think a lot of what Mahomes did well, 6 of 7 behind the line of scrimmage to the left side, 4 of 4 behind the line of scrimmage to the right side, almost a 12 for 15 right over the middle in that intermediate area. I think that's what teams kind of started taking away from Kansas City. You know, they started to prevent him from just dumping the ball off to these two players with incredible yards after the catch ball skills. And the Raiders really just didn't seem to have much of an interest in doing that. This was another one of those deals where I think some of his intermediate options were open, unlike they have been in previous weeks too.
Yeah, and I think he was a little bit more accurate, but it's a great point, Connor, that some of this was on the Raiders' defense and leaving guys open and not necessarily requiring perfect accuracy from Mahomes and not taking advantage of the fact that he had been a little bit off on some throws throughout the season.
So as far as the Raiders go, I mean, this season that had sort of started as such a pleasant surprise, and then you have just numerous things going wrong off the field, from John Gruden to Henry Ruggs to Damon Arnett. But they're now looking at back-to-back losses here. They're sitting at 5-4 in a very competitive conference in a very competitive division. And I don't know, this was the first time, even last week in the loss to the Giants, which is a bad loss because the Giants are maybe not a quality opponent, you know, you can sort of say, okay, well, you know, two really good plays by Xavier McKinney turned into interceptions. They stalled in the red zone a couple of times, but there was no fundamental, like, oh my goodness, we can't solve this type of thing. This was the first time offensively that they just looked out of sorts. And look, maybe if Deshaun Jackson doesn't get stripped downfield, this game takes on something of a different feel, but you had no run game. You had very little Darren Waller in this game. It just seemed like they weren't able to do anything they wanted to do out there.
Yeah, Gary, I think the Deshaun Jackson play, the fumble, was a tipping point in the game. The score is 24-14 at that point, and he makes a big play, gets the Raiders within striking distance, and then loses the ball. And the Chiefs recover, and it allows the momentum to swing the Chiefs' way. And from there, they just really blow things wide open. But the Raiders looked a little bit off all game long. They looked like a team that has been through a lot this season. And even the fact, for instance, that they are bringing in Deshaun Jackson midseason to try to patch up things where, you know, obviously you lose Ruggs under really unfortunate and tragic circumstances. So it's just a promising start that's been kind of extinguished. And if you look at the division overall, right, you start out and you think, okay, this is the year that the Chargers, and the Raiders could really steal one from the Chiefs. And now here we are just after the midway point and the Chiefs are back on top.
I'm contractually obligated not to release any more Raiders hot takes on the website for a little while, just to kind of keep us below the radar. But if I were able to write a negative Raiders piece on the website this week, I would caution anybody from birthing what is going to be the worst retort for all of this is going to be, Gruden finally figured it out, man, but the NFL pulled the rug on it, and then we couldn't make the playoffs after that. But Gruden had it all figured out. That is going to be the refrain from Raiders fans, and I'm here to tell you that that's not true. This team was not going to make the playoffs with or without him as their head coach this year. I think the other stuff probably ended up burying them, but the one good thing that the Raiders have going for them right now is Derek Carr. And on that Deshaun Jackson catch, the fact that he stepped up into the pocket, had the clear check down right to his left side, and that's a throw, that's a check down that he takes 10 times out of 10 at any other point in his career, but instead he steps up, finds a receiver that just joined the team a week ago. He's getting all these plus plays. I think he's playing like a top 10 quarterback. That's the one reason you have for hope moving forward, and I think you know, if you keep some of the foundational pieces around him, you probably can make the playoffs in the future with a coach who's not John Gruden.
I was going to say this defense kind of looked like what we thought it would look like when the season started. And quite frankly, the Chiefs took advantage of their aggressiveness, whether it be the screen game, whether it be, they used Travis Kelce sort of on these delayed releases, staying in to help block and then sent him out. I mean, this is the danger with running the sort of more simplistic zone type defense that Gus Bradley runs. I mean, there are answers to it, and we might just be seeing teams start to exploit those answers from here on in.
Or start to exploit them specifically for this version of the cover three with the Raiders, but the cover three has been exploited for a long time, right? Which made the Gus Bradley hire for the Raiders such a head scratcher, because it hadn't been working for the Chargers in the same division, right? So then the Raiders hire him. That move never made sense. And I think you're exactly right, Gary. The way that the defense played tonight from the Raiders was what we expected from the beginning. And perhaps it's surprising that it took this long for them to be exposed the way that they were. But It's just not a scheme that works if you don't figure out ways to adapt and change it. And look, we've seen Dan Quinn adapt and change it in Dallas. He's not running the same cover three stuff that he ran in Seattle or in Atlanta. You have to adapt and move things around and try different approaches, and or otherwise you'll get the result that we saw against the Chiefs.
And that's what's fascinating. Like the Chiefs in particular, some of the route concepts that they designed with Tyreek Hill and Travis Kelce were specifically to beat that coverage, that defense, right? And that's what made the Chiefs so successful right away, is because they had the right personnel to destroy that kind of defense specifically. And you thought over time, it's like, okay, well, some teams are going to figure this out. Some teams are going to stop it. But then, like, it feels like you just went back to running real deal, old school, like the concepts that this offense was specifically built to defeat. And so here you are giving up, you know, a 40 burger.
Seahawks, Packers.
Okay, so I guess before we jump into this, we do have to acknowledge that our usual robot has a bye week this week. A little bit dinged up. Typical bumps and bruises you have at this point in the season. We don't think it's a long-term thing, but he's out this week. So we have, I don't know, I hope that wasn't jarring for anyone to hear a lady robot on the show this week.
Let's just cut through the BS, Gary. The previous robot lied and said he was immunized, and then, you know, we just took it to be vaccinated, and all of a sudden, here we are with a backup robot. And she's great, by the way. So
possibly the robot of the future. We'll have to see how this plays out. Oh, man. That worked out too well. So, yeah, Aaron Rodgers was back this week. Russell Wilson was back this week from the finger injury, and we were all kind of maybe expecting a good old-fashioned Rodgers versus Russ shootout here. We did not get it. We got a 17-0 Packers victory. We'll start, I guess we'll start with the quarterbacks, because they were the storyline coming in anyway. To me, Rodgers just looks like he's still kind of working through some of these some of these backups who are now elevated to starting spots. Davante Adams obviously was back this week, but no Robert Tonyan. So you had Josiah DeGuara out there who they had a couple miscommunications, and that's the way it went. But there was just not really anything going here for this Packers offense that looked a little less like the well-oiled machine it was a year ago, and a little more like, you know, sort of the improv-heavy stuff that you saw from Rodgers late in the Mike McCarthy era.
Yeah, the game reminded me of when I first got a Sega Genesis, and I didn't have anyone to play with, so I played my dad, and neither of us knew how to play. And so, like, we just ran running plays because the passing matrix seemed too difficult for us to grasp at that point. But, yeah, it was very broken. Kind of on both sides of the ball, and you know, I'm sure we'll get to AJ Dillon momentarily, but had it not been for those several sort of unconscious moments that Russell or that Aaron Rodgers and Davante Adams have built together, you know, over a long career, we really wouldn't have had really any sort of forward passing moments throughout the game. I mean, it was really just down to like muscle memory between the two of them, basically.
Yeah, Connor, as you referenced, A.J. Dillon really was essential to the offense this week, and it'll be really important for the Packers to have a run game, and Aaron Jones with his knee injury is obviously a concern. They'll get more information on that with further testing. So it was good they had A.J. Dillon to step in, and also the defense has been playing really well. The last 3 weeks they played against Patrick Mahomes, Kyler Murray, and now Russell Wilson this week, even though probably a slightly diminished Russell Wilson, still coming off of the finger injury. But the identity of the Packers, or at least how they've won games the last few weeks, has been a little different. And maybe that's the mark of a multidimensional team. There's a handful of really good teams in the NFC, and the Packers are one of them. And even though their offense didn't look like world beaters today, they had other ways to win.
Yeah, it's always nice when you can win in a variety of ways, and that's kind of what we're seeing from the Packers of late here. Yeah, Joe Barry, you know, not only doing it defensively, but doing it without Jaire Alexander, without Za'Darius Smith, and with a bunch of injuries in the linebacking core, and, you know, this has been a nice run here for this defense. it'll depend what they do in January and February as far as what the ultimate narrative will be, and you can ask Mike Pettine about that. But yeah, this is a nice little run for the defense, and I thought A.J. Dillon closed out this game nicely. Scoring touchdowns in the red zone is a skill, and he scored on two third down runs, which really ended up putting this one away. As far as the Seahawks go, I mean, look, it was not a very Russell Wilson-like performance from this offense. And, you know, there's no Chris Carson, as we know. The run game is maybe not regulating this offense as effectively as it normally would. But, I mean, they were on the field for less than 21 minutes. You just look at Russell's stat line here, you know, 20 for 40, 161 yards, the one interception was at the very end, but he had the other interception. This was not vintage Russell Wilson we were watching here.
Yeah, it from both quarterbacks, but, you know, you could say it from, especially from Russell Wilson's point of view, because, you know, as his sort of backfield theatrics are such a big part of his game, but he looked uncomfortable evading contact, which is, like, not a normal thing for him, right? And I don't know if he was worried about, he was a little bit more hypersensitive, like he didn't want to bang his hand into somebody, or, you know, maybe he didn't want to re-injure the area, but there's a lot of that. There was a lot of discomfort in the pocket, and then there was a lot of, like, you know, and maybe it's just towards the end of the half or towards the end of the game and those throws stood out, but there was a lot of just like these listless bombs, you know, like, and I guess that's what happens. You give a quarterback credit for throwing those down 17, which is what a lot of people always said about Eli Manning, for example. Like, the team was down and he just didn't care, and so he would like lob these passes, and that's why his interception total was a little bit higher. But you know, it looked a little bit broken. And I will say too that credit for the Packers and the refereeing crew for like allowing a little bit of physicality. It didn't seem like there was a lot of separation in the defensive backfield, and when there was, the refs kind of let them play a little bit, which hurt guys like Lockett and kind of forbade Russell Wilson from kind of getting that deep pass that sort of energizes their passing game so much.
Yeah, and Wilson insisted that he didn't come back too soon from finger surgery. Certainly the coverage of his return was breathless. The lengths he went through to come back this week seemed to be at least slightly exaggerated, or maybe not exaggerated, just, you know, really some interesting tones, I would say, describing his return from the finger surgery. And he said there were just two bad plays from him. But I agree, Connor. It was just the ball placement was a little bit off. The accuracy wasn't what we expected from Wilson. And also the comfort in extending plays and figuring out ways to make those big connections downfield. So nothing was clicking, and I thought it was interesting at the end of the game, Tony Romo says, oh, I still think the Seahawks are going to be fine, and Jim Nantz kind of was in disbelief. He's like, well, what do you mean? They're 3-6? And then Tony Romo was like, oh, I think Russell will get it together, and the defense has been playing well, or playing better as the season goes along. But it was interesting in like the two disparate perspectives on things, that Romo was like, Wilson's going to figure it out. He's going to get better. The team will still be in the mix. And then Nantz looking at the reality of where they're at, which is 3-6 in a division with two of the top teams in the NFC, obviously the Rams and the Cardinals at the top of it. So they're in a tough spot.
I don't know why, and we can get at this a little bit more deeper into the show, but there seems to be such a boat race for this seventh seed in the NFC, and like, why are teams trying to do this? Like, you almost don't want to make, like, I hate to be like the guy that's standing up here and saying you don't want to make the playoffs this year, but you don't want to make the playoffs this year. Like, you're just prolonging a bad season that's going to go nowhere. I don't, like, you know, the NFC playoffs are open and shut. There's two really good teams. Like, nobody else is making it out of there. Three really good teams. I don't know. I just thought it was kind of, crazy, you know? Who would want it anyway?
I think that could be an interesting tournament there in the NFC. I mean, everyone should be trying to make the playoffs. You never know what might happen. That's my lesson to everyone out there. But
I think there's more than two really good teams, Connor.
Three.
I don't think anyone's very good.
Three, like, amazing teams. You know what I mean? Like three, like really, really, really good teams, and then you know everybody else is like, okay, I don't know.
Packers, Cowboys, Cardinals, Rams,
Bucks.
I would. Yeah,
the Bucks like, had a okay. bad week, but
yeah, like four. Okay, so four really good teams. Yeah.
See, I think all those teams have question marks. I mean, I like the Cowboys probably better than the rest of those teams right now, and I don't even like the Cowboys that much.
Well, this is the season of question marks. Pretty much every team has one of those losses that you're just like, wow, where did that come from?
Well, I think this is a good time to get to a Jenny Vrentis victory lap.
Yes.
Browns, Patriots.
So there you go. Patriots are the hottest team in the NFL right now. Fourth straight win, and all these wins just coming in pretty convincing style at this point.
You know, Gary, I didn't have the courage to say it earlier in the season, but when they started 1-3, I was thinking to myself, the Patriots are always bad in September. Like, even mm-hmm. with Tom Brady, they're like often 2-2. So 1-3 didn't really seem that far off from that. Maybe I just didn't quite trust things enough, even though I did pick them to win the AFC East. But I think we are seeing things come together for the Patriots. The offensive line being healthier now is a big piece of that. We saw a really dominant run game, but also Mac Jones is really progressing to the point where he's now making some of those throws that you're like, wow, that was a little bit of a risk. He's threading the needle there. His development this season has been pretty cool to watch.
Yeah, we had all been, I had been hypercritical of Belichick in certain situations earlier this year, especially that Bucks game where you didn't let Mac Jones go for it on fourth down, and instead you opt for the Nick Folk, the really long Nick Folk kick, which I think would have tied his career long in the rain. But to your point, and Jenny, you actually brought this up during that show, and I've been thinking about it a lot ever since. You know, he has a touch for this. Like, he understands, you know, how much a quarterback can take on his plate, how much a quarterback should have on his plate. He had more information on Mac Jones going into this season than probably any other coach in the NFL in terms of his ability to take stuff on. And he's been phenomenal in terms of delegating to Mac Jones, in terms of what Mac Jones can handle, and his growth has been exponential. You know, it's like one of the most mechanical sort of evolutions of a quarterback that we've seen in recent memory in NFL history.
This team just kind of has a feel right now, the way they're going, it has that same feel that they had the last time they won the Super Bowl. Now, the quarterback is different. Mac Jones, as well as he is playing, is not playing as well as Brady did during that Super Bowl 53 run. However, the defense is doing what they have done over those, you know, over that really good run. And the power run game is back. I mean, Ramondre Stevenson was filling in for Damian Harris in this one, and he was absolutely dominant. I mean, he was just dragging, Cleveland's linebackers with him consistently downfield here. And this is a team, since they had -1 rushing yard in that loss to the Bucks, I mean, they've consistently been up there well over 100 yards every game. They went for 184 in this one, granted playing with the lead for the majority of the game, but it was, you know, it was a legit 184. It was a well-earned 184 in a game where they just sort of, you know, front five was winning. They had a beat on what the Browns were doing, and Stevenson just sort of went where he wanted to go.
It'll be interesting to see in the coming weeks, because we'll have some tests for the Patriots. While the back half of their schedule is, there are some soft spots, coming up are some difficult spots, because they have Atlanta next week, but after that, it's the Titans and the Bills in back-to-back weeks, and then they play the Bills a second time in December. So it's going to be an interesting stretch for the AFC East, and there's a lot more theater to the division than we thought early on in the season. But then after that, you know, their last two games are the Jaguars and the Dolphins. So those could potentially be good places for them to pick up wins. I like them as a playoff team, and they are still very much in the mix to win the division.
Do you think that if the Patriots make the playoffs and the Buccaneers don't, or if the Buccaneers lose in the first round, people start asking stupid questions about, like, was it really Bill Belichick all along? You know, I think people owe Bill Belichick an apology. That's what I'm trying to say. You're all very mean to him after the Patriots won, or the Buccaneers won the Super Bowl. Very mean.
That narrative will be so spectacularly stupid. I can't wait for it.
It's going to be awesome.
It was stupid last year, and it will be stupid this year, and it will be stupid for the rest of time.
Stupid for the rest of time. I'll preempt everybody else by bringing this up. The team that I picked to make and or win the Super Bowl is not performing well at this point, and I actually have a column on our website at this moment, basically waving the white flag on my Super Bowl pick here. Yeah, they're not making the playoffs. They're definitely not making the playoffs. My Oracle vibes were completely off on this, and their end of season schedule is brutal. It's really difficult. So, I don't know what happens here. And I think it's weird then, because you sort of funnel into an off season now where you have to figure out the quarterback stuff, and you almost like, I don't know. I mean, unless you're getting Kirk Cousins or somebody else like that. I mean, I don't know. This team can't draft somebody right now. So they have to get into the mix for a veteran quarterback.
Yeah, I think it's going to be the last few weeks of the season, and then what they do in the off season, just going to be an interesting string of events, Connor. But one thing I will point out is that the Browns' two biggest losses of the season, the biggest deficits, were both without Nick Chubb. And it really does look like a different team when they don't have Chubb. They didn't have Chubb or Hunt available in this game. And so the run game has been so important to how Kevin Stefanski builds his offense, and Nick Chubb in particular. So I think when you see performances like this, that is one of the root causes. Also, Myles Garrett's comments after the game that they were not able to make in-game adjustments, or the defense doesn't make adjustments on the sideline, were eyebrow raising, and, you know, potentially some heat on the defensive coordinator as a result.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I followed Connor onto this Browns bandwagon, and now that you're getting off, I'm like frantically like begging you to get back on, and you're just saying like, no. I was a fraud the whole time. Like, no, I believe in you.
I jumped out of the Volvo, and you're in the passenger seat trying to take hold. Here's the problem. Remaining opponents: Packers, Ravens, Raiders, Steelers, Bengals, Lions. So in there, right, you probably have one built-in win. The Raiders probably aren't what they seem to be at this point, so maybe like two built-in wins there, but it's going to be tough. And granted, the AFC North, nobody's taking away with that division. The Ravens lost to the Dolphins. The Steelers just tied the Lions, and so it's not like there's any world beaters in here, but I'm starting to get freaked out. So before we clip this, because I know now we have a clip of me saying they're definitely not making the playoffs, let me unclip that. And let me reclip it by saying I still believe in this team to some degree, but just not nearly as strongly as I believed in them in the future. That could include a trip to the playoffs, but I'm feeling less confident about that as the days go on.
Okay, I just have to chime in here. I have known Connor for 10 years. Gary, he's not actually jumping off the bandwagon. This is his little reverse jinx thing. He's just going to put it out there. Nope, they're not going to make the playoffs even, with the hope that his preseason oracle of them either making or winning the Super Bowl will come true. I'm just calling this what it is.
It's really hard that I can't sneak anything by you anymore. It's very disappointing.
I feel like it was kind of a test of my faith after following Connor down this path.
No, it's just knowing that I could get away with it with you, but I wasn't sure if Jenny was going to say anything. So
I couldn't let it slide. Had to chime in.
Panthers, Cardinals.
All right, so all sorts of quarterbacks we did not expect to see in this game end up playing in the Panthers-Cardinals game. Kyler Murray out again. The Cardinals are obviously playing it very safe with their MVP caliber quarterback there, but PJ Walker and Cam Newton are under center for the Panthers here, and Carolina just jumps out to an early lead and absolutely cruises in a game that was not competitive in any way.
Yeah, good for PJ Walker, too. Like, I thought it was good that, you know, there's been a couple of preseason games where he's looked really good. And I think a lot of times, especially early in the, you know, during some of the portions of the season where Sam Darnold was struggling, everyone was like, why aren't we just throwing this guy in? Like, he's pretty good. And then, you know, everybody else kind of figured out the same thing that the Patriots figured out last year, which is that there's still no more dominant goal line weapon in the NFL than Cam Newton. And he sort of takes a trip inside the 5 yard line and makes it go from like an 80% chance that you're going to do something good to like a 97% chance that you're going to do something good. So kudos to them. I thought this was sort of a Band-Aid on a giant bullet, you know, on a giant bullet wound, but it does seem like, you know, they got a W against a Kyler Murray-less Cardinals team, but they did kind of save their season there. They're another team, you know, when I'm talking about trying to speed out for the seventh playoff spot, they kind of define that search for me, right? I mean, they've been hyper aggressive. They've acquired more defensive backs when their other guys go down, and now plugging Cam Newton into the equation, they want this seventh seed like bat more badly than any other team that I can pinpoint in the NFC.
Yeah, when you said that comment earlier, I was thinking of the Panthers because, you know, they still have a lot of work to do on the roster ahead of themselves. So making the playoffs this year isn't going to be the end all be all. If they do make the playoffs, it probably won't be a very long playoff run. So, you know, that you don't want a playoff bid to sort of deter them from the work that we know they need to do in the offseason. But at the same time, this was an exciting win for the Panthers. And, you know, the moment of Cam Newton coming in, scoring touchdowns on his first two touches, franchise icon returning to his team. And he said, you know, a week ago he was eating cereal. So it was a pretty cool moment to see that. On the flip side, it's hard to call it a bad loss for the Cardinals when you're without Kyler Murray and DeAndre Hopkins again. I think it makes sense to play it safe, as Gary said, with Murray's ankle injury, but it does tick them down in the standings, and it's going to be a tight race for the top of the NFC West with the Rams. And you would have hoped that the defense would have played a little bit better against a team that was using number two quarterback and a quarterback who just joined the team a handful of days ago.
Just got there 5 days ago. Yeah, I'm sure Vance Joseph was kind of wishing Sam Darnold was under center this week for the Panthers. Yeah, as far as the Panthers go, they do own the seven seed right now. If they ended the season right now, which I don't know, maybe they should make things more interesting. The Panthers would make the playoffs. I think a team like that, I mean, this isn't like a last gasp, everything is broken type of franchise, maybe like the Bears were, where it felt like the window was shrinking and, you know, you're sort of making a run at being a one-and-done playoff team. I think it's helpful to have a sort of a taste of the postseason if you're this young Panthers team. And look, whether they're picking, you know, 19 or 14 in the draft this upcoming spring, it really doesn't make a difference. It's not the difference between like landing a potential franchise quarterback and not. If that guy is in this draft and it is looking like a fairly thin draft as far as quarterbacks go, you know, they'll have to spend a bunch of capital to move up one way or another. But yeah, I don't know. There was certainly different energy to this team this week with Cam under center, and they can sort of grasp a different offensive identity at this point. Instead of trying to run something a little more traditional with Darnold or even PJ Walker, I mean, you can you can do a Taysom Hill type of deal with Cam and sort of, you know, emphasize and lean on this 11-man running game and see how far it takes you at this point.
It maximizes Christian McCaffrey too. I mean, you're basically playing off your strengths and you're utilizing the best weapons. And I think it, you know, to your point, it does make you harder to defend because of such a pivot at the midseason point, right? So like most of the film that you have to this point is almost entirely useless. And we don't know what Joe Brady looks like with a mobile quarterback to some degree, right? I mean, we've almost never seen him. I don't think we've ever seen him, right? Coordinate an offense with a quarterback who can escape the pocket. It was Joe Burrow. It was Teddy Bridgewater. It was Sam Darnold. And now it's completely different.
Falcons, Cowboys.
All right, well, the Cowboys certainly got back on track this week. This was as lopsided an NFL game I can remember seeing in recent memory. It was just a complete blowout. On one hand, yes, very good news for the Cowboys. Dak Prescott looked like he had looked early in the season. It looked like his calf was not bothering him, et cetera, et cetera. But look, I couldn't help but think of Dan Quinn as this game was unfolding. And it did, because of a couple of different approaches that the Falcons took, or excuse me, that the Cowboys took, it did feel like it was maybe a little bit personal at this point for the former Falcons head coach. Can I give you, let me set this up. All right. I want to give you the quote that Arthur Smith gave to Albert Breer in MMQB last week. And I don't think Arthur Smith meant this to be directed at Dan Quinn or anyone who is there under Dan Quinn. But if I'm Dan Quinn and I see this quote, I can't help but feel a little bit called out at that point. So after beating the Saints in sort of a back and forth game last week, Arthur Smith was kind of feeling himself and says, and he's used this before, this football league's not for soft souls. He's used that before. So he says, this football league's not for soft souls. You got to play every down. You're on the road. It's not the same old Falcons. And so we found a way to finish. And then he added, soft souls, we got them out of here. Which is, again, maybe not intended to be directed at Dan Quinn, but if you're Dan Quinn and you see this quote, it's like, well, I'm out of here and a bunch of my friends are out of here, so I'm not sure who else you're referring to at this point.
Really tough talk from a guy who looks like the avatar of like the unnamed coach in Madden. Like, Arthur Smith is the most generic looking human, like least intimidating and most generic looking human being in the NFL. And so it's encouraging to see him hop into the trash talk, world. But yeah, that was great. And there was a shot of a very satisfied looking Dan Quinn up in the defensive coordinator's booth at the end of this game. So I think that comment was heard, and it was certainly played upon, which, like, you would like to think that a defensive coordinator doesn't need to be, you don't need to make him mad in order to get a great defensive game plan out of him. But at this point, you know, I don't know, whatever works. I'm totally up for it.
Yeah, I think also Julio Jones came to mind with that quote, Gary. But I agree with you. The not the same old Falcons. The Falcons had a lot of success under Dan Quinn. I also didn't care much for Arthur Smith's quote about this isn't the real house as a flowery branch. I thought that was a little bit sexist. Didn't really like the connotations there. Plenty of NFL locker rooms have more drama than any reality show. So yes. Just want to put that out there. But, you know, I've heard from coaches that facing your former team, especially a team that you were recently fired from, can go one of two ways. And I remember one coach telling me that he had an experience where it went the opposite way, that his players felt so much pressure to perform for him that they just were, the energy level was totally sapped once the game began. Obviously, this went the right way for Dan Quinn. And I think you've seen all season this Cowboys defense has looked totally different from last year. And Dan Quinn is pushing the right buttons and developing players. Trevon Diggs is a great example of a young player who's really ascended the scheme. And Micah Parsons, a rookie, in a huge role for the defense. And Dan Quinn has been essential to his development, right? So I think that you have a lot of guys who have a genuine affection and respect for Quinn. So I think playing hard for him came naturally. And yeah, I think they played harder, maybe longer than you would in a game that got out of hand. They wanted to keep it going and really make it a statement, if you will. And I think they definitely did.
Yeah, I think there was there was sort of an exercising of their previous week's loss to Denver. I think that factors into that too. Like, you wanted to have them enjoy themselves and beat up on an opponent. But from a defensive coordinator's perspective, you know, some coaches that I've talked to said there are just those games where, you know, what you're dialing up works, and then you get ahead to the point where not that it doesn't matter what you call, but if you're, especially if you're facing an offense like the Falcons, where it requires certain things to make it run and you kind of know what they're doing and they don't have a dominant sort of running game to get themselves back into it, you can sort of dial up something and sort of pin your ears back and get after them for the rest of the game. It seemed like that's what Dallas did. They had a good time and it felt like they were, you know, every call Dan Quinn was like, you know, hitting a beach ball with a baseball bat. And so, you know, it was probably a very enjoyable experience for them.
I just want to point out real quick, the end of the first half here. So the Cowboys scored a touchdown, got a two-point conversion, went up 36-3 with 37 seconds left. The Cowboys had one timeout left. The Falcons, on the first play from scrimmage, ran the ball, lost 5 yards. Everyone's getting ready to go into the locker room. The Cowboys called timeout. That they weren't going to be able to get the ball back. They called timeout and made the Falcons run another play. And there was a shot of Arthur Smith, who's kind of like behind his play call sheet, and someone like notes to him that the clock has been stopped, and he just has this baffled look on his face. They made him go out and run another play. And then they went, at the end of the third quarter, they went, Cowboys went for it on fourth down, deep in Falcons territory, and Dak Prescott ends up lowering his shoulder and scoring a touchdown. And it tasted a little bit different. I don't know.
Buccaneers, Washington.
All right, so we'll talk a little bit about what's right with Washington. I don't know if that's a lengthy conversation, but we'll get to it in a second. But I guess we're going to start with what's wrong with the Bucs at this point. For a second straight week, they just don't look particularly good and lose a game to a team that they probably shouldn't be losing to.
Yeah, there was a lot of conversation that last year after the bye week was when things turned around. Totally different circumstance, because that was when Bruce Arians and Tom Brady had kind of their meeting of the minds and melded their offenses together. So this year's bye week wasn't going to be as dramatic, but they had just come off that bad loss to the Saints, ticked off about that. They have a bye week. You expected them to come out roaring against Washington, a lowly opponent, and it was just the opposite. And, you know, it was interesting that Bruce Arians was critical of Brady. He put both interceptions on him, even though the first one was definitely not on Brady. The receiver had it, and then it got jarred loose, and it could have even been a fumble. The way that it worked out, it didn't touch the ground, and so it ended up being an interception, but definitely not on Brady. So I don't know if they're like looking for some kind of mid-season spark like they had last year, but if they're looking for that, there's not going to be a way to generate what happened last season, because last season was when they basically turned the offense over to Brady or made it more Brady-like. I don't know what this year's, you know, jolt of energy is going to be like at the bye week. So obviously, though, Brady was ticked off after the game. He had a very terse post-game press conference, and certainly was a game that he did not expect to lose.
The whole thing is sort of weird. Like, I wonder why. Like, the whole narrative was that Brady was sick of basically being treated like a subhuman by Bill Belichick in New England, and so that's why he went to Tampa. But, like, throughout his entire time in Tampa, Bruce Arians has blamed largely all of the offense's woes on Tom Brady. And it's just like, you know, are you really being treated that differently? And, you know, it's just kind of interesting to see how that works. But, yeah, I mean, you could tell that, you know, the Buccaneers are missing some components of their offense. And it's strange to say that about a unit that's so loaded. But it's almost like once you start removing some of the layers there, it does show not a thinness to it, but perhaps a dependence on, you know, having all-stars that can win at every position. And this is not to say that Brady cannot win without them. Please don't, you know, take it that way. But, you know, I'm saying that, like, I think that there is probably an easier time in creating mismatches and winning and beating your opponents when you had, like, Antonio Brown as your third, like, your slot receiver.
Yeah, and look, I'll make two quick points on Brady, and then we can praise the Washington football team. But you kind of saw this with Brady going back to the Patriots days. When he has his full complement of weapons and can do everything he wants to do, they kind of do what they want. You know, whether it was, you know, when Gronkowski was hurt a little bit, or when Julian Edelman would lose some time, or that sort of thing, they would always just slide back. And right now, Antonio Brown, when he's on the field, is arguably the best receiver in football. I mean, they have totally recaptured what Brown was in Pittsburgh on the field, and it has made a big difference. I mean, they're three losses this year. They were missing Brown for each of those games. I think he is a difference maker when he's on the field, considering what Brady is right now. And I guess my other point is, if Bruce Arians really wants to get this on track, what he has to do is go get Gardner Minshew, open up the quarterback competition, and really split the snaps here. And that's how you get a quarterback going.
Gary never misses an opportunity. The other quick thing.
That's the other guy in North Florida.
Oh, man. The other quick thing on the Bucs is the defense is just not playing as well as it was last year. And so I think the play of the defense was able to mask some flaws of the offense last year, or games when they weren't getting things going and were still figuring things out. Particularly the injuries on the back end of the defense and the secondary have really been a problem. So you also don't have that complement. There were so many times in the game where it was like, they just need to get Washington off the field. And they couldn't get Tyler Heinicke off the field, which I think transitions into your next point, Gary. But that, I think, was probably the biggest difference in a game like this.
You know what kind of stinks about weeks like this, though? Like, it's not fun anymore. Like, Tom Brady is so established as the greatest player in NFL history. And it's like, we can't be like, and we could do it last year, right? With the four downs game where he forgot what down it was. And we could just be like, aha, look at this guy. Like, he can't win without Bill Belichick. But now that he's like so firmly established as the greatest player in NFL history, like, you can't even enjoy these games because like he shows up to the post game press conference and he's like, I don't have to answer any of this. Like, I'm the greatest player in NFL history. Everyone knows we're going to figure this out. And so, you know, there's like no grand conclusions that can be drawn from this, and like it's not enjoyable for somebody who likes to find fault in other people.
It's true. The window closed. The window it's last over. Year was yeah. to be like, oh well, it was all Belichick, as you can now see, but that's out. Yeah,
I bought a timeshare on that island. Like I was prepared to retire there and spend all of my days on it was Belichick Island, and here I am, you know, stuck with basically a property that's unrentable in the middle of a swampland.
Taylor Heinicke on the other side of this. So look, it was kind of neat seeing Heinicke out there against the Bucs again. This was kind of his, you know, this was his moment last year in the playoffs, where obviously they didn't win the game, but he looked impressive enough to basically earn his way onto the roster. And then with the Ryan Fitzpatrick injury, he's out there. But you said it, Jenny. I mean, this Washington offense is not a good third down offense. They haven't been a good third down offense under Heinicke, or really under any quarterback the last couple of years. But they went 11 for 19 on third down, and then they picked up two short fourth downs. So, you know, that's basically 13 for 21, and that's not something you should let Taylor Heinicke do to your defense.
Saints, Titans.
All right, so these are two just super weird teams right now, and I guess we'll start with the Titans side of it, and we've all kind of wondered, okay, Derrick Henry's out, what's going to happen, and it kind of hasn't mattered offensively to this point. I mean, this is an offense, they're averaging 3.7 yards per play over the last 2 weeks, and they left with wins in both games, so it really hasn't mattered that they have not been able to answer that question of what they're going to be post Derrick Henry here, and no Julio Jones in this one either. But right now they're doing it with defense, and they're doing it with whatever you want to chalk it up to. They have gotten timely turnovers deep in opponent territory. They got one on the second half kickoff that turned into immediate points. And that is why the Titans are winning games right now.
Big turnovers, an easily replicable thing, Gary, as you know. You know, one of those things that a team can just depend on week in and week out. So awesome that the Buccaneers or the Titans can have that for the long term. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that there is an element of, and I'm not saying that Derrick Henry is not important. Please don't take what I'm about to say as Derrick Henry is not important. But there is an efficiency to this offense that I think that you can somehow kind of get the kind of more granular effect of with this platoon of running backs, and the fact that they're running away with it so significantly makes it seem like, and again, their end of season strength of schedule, I believe they have the friendliest end of season schedule left in the NFL. They have the easiest second half schedule remaining in the NFL. Like, they could easily be the number one seed in the AFC and then get Derrick Henry back after a bye week, right? I mean, you know, this is not out of the realm of possibility. It seems like they're sort of setting themselves up for that.
Yeah, and Connor, the AFC has been so strange this season that it's hard to find a team that you feel like you can count on week to week. The Titans are probably the closest thing to that, even though they did lose to the Jets earlier this season. And it's just sort of strange because they now don't have their best offensive weapon. It hasn't mattered the last 2 weeks. At the same time, I will say that the Saints could have won this game. They were in position to, they at least had a chance. There was that awful roughing the passer call on Ryan Tannehill that kept that drive alive and for the Titans to score a touchdown early in the game. So it wasn't a dominant performance by the Titans by any means. But the fact that they're still continuing to win games and still have a clear lead in the AFC post the Henry injury, I think you're right, Connor. It's very possible that they could get through this softer final stretch and have a chance to get him back.
I have only the utmost respect for Ryan Tannehill, but I cannot believe the two roughing the passer flags he's gotten the past 2 weeks, which are among, I don't know, I mean, you'd have to go through the greatest hits, but they're among the worst I've seen in recent history. And on top of that, the one today, it took an interception off the board. It was a red zone interception. You get a phantom roughing the passer call, and they end up getting the ball back. They actually got a few plays later on third and goal. They got a ticky-tack pass interference call to keep it alive again, and they end up scoring the touchdown. But yeah, this is a team that, look, sometimes you get breaks, and breaks help you win games, and they are right now figuring out what they want to be offensively and defensively. I mean, that defense is kind of taking over a little bit. Two more sacks today for Jeffrey Simmons, who, by the way, I went to look up, not because I been on any of this stuff, but I was curious to see what Jeffrey Simmons' Defensive Player of the Year odds were, and he's not even on the board.
Wow.
What? What is this?
So are you saying people should put some money down? Or can you not even put money down because he's not even on the board?
All of your money. Find somewhere where he's on the board and put all your money down. And then don't come to me when he doesn't win it.
Lions, Steelers.
All right. So this was a tie. This was just unsatisfactory in so many ways. No Ben Roethlisberger. He ends up in COVID protocol, so Mason Rudolph ends up getting the start here for the Steelers. It was just a bad game between bad teams. The one thing I was kind of hopeful for, and I've talked about this multiple times here, was this was another opportunity for the Steelers against a team that they can pass protect against. Just like Monday night, they could keep their quarterback clean against that Bears pass rush minus Khalil Mack, and they just don't do it. They just don't go downfield. They went downfield a couple times early. They got a long pass interference penalty. Mason Rudolph isn't a great downfield passer. They were missing some weapons, but still, it just felt like a week they could take a couple of shots, and they didn't. It's just the same thing they keep on trotting out every week. And I don't know. I guess I have to learn to live with that at this point.
Yeah, well, I still don't understand why Mason Rudolph is the option here. Like, if you were a backup quarterback strategically plotting where you would want to go in order to get snaps at some point this season, the Steelers had to be up there on your list of potential you know, ways to crack the lineup here. But Mason, I mean, the first interception was really bad, you know, just sort of a classic, like almost like high school miscommunication overthrow. I think they benefited somewhat from some pass interference stuff down the field just because, you know, the Lions were biting kneecaps while they were trying to go deep. But it was, you know, this is, you know, I don't know why this is the option. Like, the Steelers should have something better in place right now. It should look way better than this. You should not be tying the Lions at this point with the division in the balance.
Yeah, I mean, both of these teams are clearly going to be in the quarterback market in 2022 for different reasons. I think the Lions were just going to give Jared Goff a try this year and see if it worked out. He came as part of the Matthew Stafford trade, but I think we've seen enough at this point that he hasn't worked out. It'll be interesting if maybe, I know there was some optimism about Tim Boyle. He's been injured for the early part of the season. Maybe when he gets healthy, they give him a try instead. And then obviously the Steelers haven't had a succession plan for Ben Roethlisberger. And that showed up this time with Roethlisberger missing the game with COVID-19 and your backup going in. But they, you know, shines a light on the bigger problem is that who is going to take over when Ben Roethlisberger's time is up, which it looks like it very well might be after this season.
Yeah, boy, it was just, and if you're Dan Campbell, you're just watching this, you know, they had a 48-yard field goal attempt to win it in overtime, and Ryan Santoso, who, by the way, had never attempted a kick longer than 35 yards in the NFL, ended up, I mean, he kicked it like a guy who maybe does not have range out to 48 yards and just missed it by a very wide margin. Other than that, just, you know, like just a couple of tip balls that end up in your defensive back's hands that end up falling to the ground, just not quite taking advantage of some of the opportunities here. By the same token, they got three takeaways in this game. They did not turn over once. Two of those takeaways were, you know, one was a Diontae Johnson was stripped downfield in what might have been basically a game winning type of catch and run play in overtime. And then, you know, Steelers are getting ready to kick a field goal or try a field goal at the end of overtime. And Pat Freiermuth, the rookie tight end, just a little quick out, and all he has to do is catch it and go down, and then you spike the ball, and then your kicker comes out, and he ends up getting stripped, and that's how the game pretty much ended here, and it was, I guess, a little bit fitting in that way.
Gary, I was stunned that this game wasn't in the lightning-ish round.
It just felt like a milestone for Dan Campbell and the Lions.
Okay.
It's okay. It counts as a half a win in the standings, mm-hmm. if you're calculating mm-hmm. their playoff odds now. But yeah, it's just, I don't know. This is a tough one for both teams to take at this point. And it was really a tough one for us to talk about.
I have two questions about this because I want to prolong how awful this game was. And I want to take up more pod space on it.
Of course,
but,
yeah.
Dan Campbell, do you celebrate your first tie in the NFL if you lost 8 consecutive games to start your coaching career?
No.
Okay. No. Jared Goff, do you celebrate the first time that you have not lost with a head coach not named Sean McVay?
No.
I feel like both him and Dan Campbell can just get like a nice warm, like a macchiato at Starbucks or something, you know? Like not a victory champagne, but like a victory flat white. Is that a coffee? A flat white?
Yeah, I mean, normally there's Victory Monday in the NFL. Maybe that Lions could do Tie Tuesday.
Tie Tuesday, yeah.
Bring in like, flat whites for the whole. Oh, yeah, flat whites in the morning, Thai food in the evening, make a whole event out of it.
Yeah, that's what I would do. I mean, at that point, you know, like, where else are you going? And what would every player remember after that season? Tie right. Tuesday, you know?
Oh, I thought you were going to say avoiding 0-17. But yes, Tie Tuesday, definitely.
That is significant. There was a chance they were going to be the first 17-loss team in the NFL. So
right.
That's a thing.
Something to celebrate.
Vikings Chargers.
All right, so we'll start with the Vikings side of this, and I will give Mike Zimmer some credit. Last week, Jenny and I were quite critical of him and his decision to play for the tie at the end of regulation instead of going for 2 in the win in Baltimore in a game they ultimately lost. And in this one, he let his offense clinch the game here. They got into a 4th-and-2 situation at the Chargers 36. They were playing with a 7-point lead. There were 2.5 minutes left, and they went for it. And they end up getting the 4th down conversion and putting the game away. And this is a team that, no matter what happens, every one of their games comes down to Kirk Cousins having to put together a final minute drive to either tie it or get the win. And for once, they just go out and they get in like victory formation and win.
You know, in Mike Zimmer's defense, perhaps last week he was looking to have a tie Tuesday at the facility now that we know that this is a thing. But yes, in this game, it was definitely the right decision. Kicking the field goal at that point, it would have been a very long field goal. And we know the Vikings' luck with field goals has not been good. If you punt it, that's a lot of time for Justin Herbert, who has been playing well despite the team's recent spate of losses. And so they went for it on fourth down and able to ice the game. Thought it was definitely a good move. And Gary Gramling, you were the only one from the MMQB to pick the Vikings, so maybe you saw this coming.
Credit for Gary now, but I'm ready to take the spotlight. I've got a Vikings hot take right now. Are you ready for this?
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah.
They're going to be the surprise team of the second half. Like, the Vikings are going to be the team of the second half. They're taking that seventh seed. I'm more confident than anything. I think the Vikings are going to take the seventh seed. I mean, all the recipes were there. Like, Kirk Cousins was playing like a top 12 quarterback coming into this week. They had a top 15 offense, a top 10 defense. All of their losses were by a touchdown or less. Two of the losses were in overtime. One of them was on a field goal, which is going to happen if you're the Vikings. But, like, it's time, you know, they get this all back on the back end. I feel like this is something that Gary would get behind, right? It's the reverse of sample size. Everything regresses to the mean. The Vikings have a bad second half schedule. They get the Bears twice. You know, they're going to kick the crap out of that offense. And I think that they're gonna pad some stats a little bit and make a nice little run in the playoffs.
What does your spreadsheet say, Gary?
I'm pulling up the spreadsheet right now to tell you exactly
excellent.
Where they ranked.
Excellent.
And by the way, I do want to point out the Cowboys were number one on the spreadsheet coming into this week. The Bills were number two. Those are two teams who had very convincing wins. Ravens were down at 22. They go into Miami and lose. This is the end, but you can read all about it. I'm not going to recap it, but it's the luck spreadsheet. I try to mitigate all the luck factors, all the small sample size stats that really swing these things. The Vikings ranked 16. There you go. That's a seventh seed. That's a seventh seed in the NFC right there.
Yes. Yeah. Right in the sweet spot. Okay.
We need to take one big step backwards and I think just introduce to the listening audience that Gary has a spreadsheet, a nebulous spreadsheet, that sort of power ranks teams in the NFL based on some hidden criteria, and none of us have access to it. And the only time we hear about it, largely, is when the spreadsheet accurately predicts something. And it's fantastic. It's either the most killer bit in podcast history, or Gary really does have excellent prognostication skills and has no use, no interest in gloating them in a big spot.
Do you question the spreadsheet? Is that what you're getting at, Connor?
I think the spreadsheet's real, and even if you were willing, even if you were willing to share it with me, I wouldn't want to see it, nor would I understand it. So I don't exactly, you know, I'm not. I don't think you've ever lied to me, so.
I will say it's a cumbersome looking worksheet. I will say that.
I'm going to have to do my own research.
Eagles, Broncos.
All right, so the Eagles, I don't know. We just kind of forget about the Eagles. We write them off every week, it feels like. They just kind of feel like an also-ran, but here they are. They're right in the thick of this NFC race, too. I will say, look, we're all kind of on the same page on sort of the way that Jalen Hurts has been wronged over the first 18 months of his NFL career, where, you know, this team drafts him in the second round and is like, you'll make a fine backup quarterback for Carson Wentz for the next 10 years. And then Carson Wentz sort of falls apart and they were like, yeah, I don't know. We're going to maybe give it to you, but let us check around with literally every other option first and see if we can do better. Oh, we can't. Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and we'll see if we can figure it out. So Hurts has been up and down this year. Like, undoubtedly, I'm not going to sit here and say he has clinched this job in any way, shape, or form, but I think you've seen more good than bad from him throughout this season, especially considering where he was from a development standpoint coming into the year. And I thought this was his most encouraging game yet. We know what he can do with his legs, but you're starting to see him really connect on some of these deep throws outside the numbers. Devontae Smith had a otherworldly catch over Patrick Surtain in this one for a touchdown. And you're starting to see a little bit more what he can do. I hope they start sort of getting him working between the numbers a little bit more and just sort of figure out exactly who he is instead of just continuing to just, I don't know, have this kind of closed-minded approach where you say, okay, he's our guy for now, and we'll go shop around for someone better this offseason.
Yeah, I feel like he's been a nice surprise both for us and probably for the Eagles. As you detailed, they didn't seem to have high expectations for him or really a plan for developing him. It was sort of the fallback option this year, but his development over the course of the season has been notable. And you mentioned the throw to Smith. There was that other excellent throw that Watkins probably should have come down with in the end zone, and you could tell that Hurts was a little bit frustrated after. And this was a good defense. The Broncos shut down Dak Prescott last week. Connor's been all on top of how good the Broncos defense is and they can be, right? So the fact that he had this kind of performance against the Broncos, I think, was notable. Not an easy place to play either.
No, that touchdown on the double move to Devonta Smith was a thing of beauty. And Jalen Hurts, I mean, he's doing all the right things. I mean, it's not only the those kind of notable highlight worthy throws, but like there was a throw in this game where he's getting like dragged down, like almost by like the front of his shoulder pads and the horse collar of his shoulder pads at the same time. And he kind of like air hooks it to Dallas Goedert right before he goes out of bounds to keep the sticks moving. Like, I think he's developing a lot of the really important things that you would need for an every down quarterback in the NFL. And if he takes his team on a little run here, I mean, you know, that's one team, right, that should go for the seventh seed, right? Because you already have three first-round picks, so who cares? Because you could get whoever you want in the draft anyway. So go for broke, you know? Get the seventh seed, establish Jalen Hurts, make the Nick Sirianni hire look good. Go get it.
Jaguars, Colts.
So this is the beginning of the lightning-ish round, and I was actually, we only have two games in lightning round. Surprising for this time of year, but I didn't know which one would go first, so that was a bit of excitement right there. This Jaguars Colts game, the Colts jump out to a 70-0 lead, which included a blocked punt return TD. The Jaguars answer with a Jamal Agnew 66-yard touchdown run. It was just I don't know, it the Colts kind of just seemed to be playing with their food a little bit and letting them hang around. And they did hang around. And this was a 3-point game in the fourth quarter. And it was probably a lot more interesting than a lot of people thought it would be.
Yeah, you know, the Jaguars riding high after their big win last week, keeping things interesting with the Colts, but ultimately ending in disappointment.
Yeah, I have nothing to say. I mean, this was, I don't know. I mean, it's not even fun to watch this team for Trevor Lawrence at this point, you know, because Trevor Lawrence is not really like, he's like so good, but he's just not like given any opportunity to succeed in this environment, and just everything looks bad and sloppy. And so I've chosen for my own, you know, for my own sanity and enjoyment purposes to just not watch the Jaguars. I'm boycotting the Jaguars for the remainder of the season.
This has just been an absolute crime against Trevor Lawrence at this point in the season, but I do want to point out my favorite stat from this game. And look, the Colts had a three-possession lead in the first quarter, and they were sort of like halfway into victory formation throughout. But, you know, like when I look at the box scores here on our StatSync account, it always lists the receivers in order of who had the most catches. So the leading receiver is considered not the most yards, but the most catches. And the leading receiver on the Colts side here was Jonathan Taylor, 6 catches, 10 yards, 1.7 per. It's the kind of game it was.
Yeah, I don't know.
Bill, this is just Jets.
Sorry. Just cut me out. Cut me out.
No, the robot was right to do it. it's time to move on and end the show here with the Bills revival here. I don't think this necessarily surprised anyone. This is a quality team. They had a certainly an off week down in Jacksonville last week. And look, I think Dawson Knox coming back makes a difference here. They get to go back to some of their two tight end looks after having to abandon that a little bit. But I don't know, maybe the story was a little more Mike White and just sort of a return to sanity when it comes to Mike White, especially where we are in this part of the country when it was kind of, I don't know, the discussion for the past 2 weeks has kind of been like, well, do you get three first rounders for Mike White or do you think you hold out for a fourth at this point? And in reality, yeah, nice win against the Bengals. It had some guys who broke tackles and made plays, probably a guy you can develop as your backup long term. But yeah, this 44 for 24, four interceptions. This is what you have in Mike White.
Well, he got his turn on the back pages of the New York tabloids. That's an exciting time in his life. But really, it's just the Jets are so frustrating to watch. And I know there's a lot of teams that are frustrating in the NFL, but because we're where we live and the fact that Connor and I are noted Jets aficionados from the years 2010 to 2011, it's just the same old story every year. And there may be a little glints of optimism or maybe not, but it just always returns to the same thing. And maybe they'll figure out a way out of this morass, but it's just kind of hard to watch another lost season.
It is. And it's so strange because they've inched towards progress at different levels, right? I mean, they beat the Bengals, they beat the Titans. And in those games, I'm like, okay, here's a team that at the least is hanging tough when, you know, the Adam Gase teams or, you know, the Todd Bowles teams, the late Todd Bowles teams, or certainly the end of Rex Ryan era teams just seem to fall apart and had no interest in being there. But then you put this game into the fold, the Colts game into the fold, the Patriots games into the fold. And these are like almost like college style blowouts. And so it does get frustrating when, you know, you're trying to hammer down what this team is. And, you know, I don't know. I was just really hoping that like Mike White would throw four more touchdowns. I enjoyed the radio chatter. I like the quarterback coming out of nowhere narrative, and Mike White just seems like the most anonymous like name in NFL history, and that would have been a very fun thing for the Jets to have kind of backed themselves into a quarterback controversy. But in a lot of ways, I think this is probably not the best thing that could have happened to them, but the fact that Zach Wilson just gets the team back, no questions asked, and if you can finish the season with some semblance of development on his part, I think you can probably chalk this up as a win still. I think you could probably come away here with, whatever, five or six wins and feel okay with yourself.
The MMQB NFL podcast is Jenny Vrentis, Connor Orr, and me, Gary Gramling. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Thanks, as always, to senior podcast producer Dan Bloom, who shapes this show more than you will ever know. Mark Moravec is emeritus editor of the MMQB, and Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL podcast. Be sure to subscribe to this feed on Apple Podcasts, and once you do, please leave a rating and review because it really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.